I'd like us to take our Bibles this morning and turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians 10 and verses, we'll be reading verses 3 through 5. In verse 3 it says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of the Christ." And I think it was in the last message that I pointed out that we don't really believe what those three verses say, because we'd be living a different life than we live. We'd be marching to a different tune, if you will, than we're currently doing. We would be doing what it does. We've been given the weapons that it talks about, that it speaks of. But the problem is, we may even believe in those weapons, but I don't think that we, as a whole, within Christendom today, have been using those weapons. Well, if nothing else, this passage of Scripture proves that we are at war, and that as Christians, we are to be engaged in that war. But regrettably, most modern Christians are passive and content to just fold their hands as if to be handcuffed and shackled, while thinking to themselves they're godly and spiritual as they travel the road of non-resistance. Now, that may be the 20th century Judeo-Christian perspective, but it certainly was not the outlook of first century Christianity. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7, the Apostle Paul declared, "I have fought the good fight." And by the way, he wasn't confessing sin when he made that statement, because in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 18, he also admonished Timothy to war a good warfare. And I don't care what the media thinks of the song we sing, "Onward, Christian Soldiers." The Apostle Paul clearly taught aggressive spiritual warfare, not passive non-resistance. Not that at times in history, in times in history the warfare has not escalated into a physical conflict, but as primarily described by the Apostle Paul, we are at least, or we should be, engaged in a war of words, wherewith we fight for the minds, the hearts, and the souls of men. Essentially, a war of God's Word. That is, His worldview versus man's words and their worldview. That's where the bottom line of the war, where the war is fought. Again, there have been times in history, and there may be times in future history, where it escalates into a physical conflict, where the enemies, and it's usually the enemy who perpetuates it, matter of fact, it's always the enemy who perpetuates the physical conflict, but where they put themselves in a physical attack mode. But until then, it's primarily a war of words, where again, we fight for the hearts and souls and minds of men. And in this war, if our weapons of warfare are truth and honesty, then it's to be expected that our enemy's weapons of warfare are lies and distortion. That only makes sense that would be the case. On September 28, 1863, Ferdinand LaSalle declared this. He said, quote, "Daily news lies. Lies by means of pure fact alone. Lies by means of invented facts. Lies by means of facts distorted into their opposites. Such were the weapons with which we were fought." End of that quote. And remember, there's nothing new under the sun. What was true then is still basically true today. And let's face it, to date, our opponents, the Antichrist, have both understood and have fought this war much better than we have. Listen again to the protocols of the learned elders of Zion as an example. Protocol number 16, Article 1, Sentence 1, it says, quote, in order to effect the destruction of all collective forces except ours, we, the elders of Zion and their lackeys, we shall emasculate the first stage of collectivism, the universities, by re-educating them, words, thoughts, ideas, by re-educating them in a new direction, end of quote. Originally, American universities were seminaries for the training of ministers. And look today what they have become. You telling me that's not fulfillment? I don't care who wrote them. The fact is, it has been, and is being fulfilled. Same protocol, Article 4, Sentence 2. It says, we shall erase from the memory of men all facts of previous centuries which are undesirable to us, end of quote. And look what they've done with our American Christian beginning. They've taken it and removed it from the textbooks that our children used to be trained with. The only place you can find the true history of America's true Christian history anymore, is found in Christian bookstores. In books such as The Light and the Glory by Peter Marshall and David Manuel. Other than that, they've erased it. Thank God for such men. Same protocol, Article 8, Sentences 1 and 2, it says, in a word, knowing by the experiences of many centuries that people live and are guided by ideas, thoughts, words, and these ideas are imbibed by people only by the aid of education provided with equal success for all ages of growth, but of course by varying methods, we shall swallow up and confiscate to our own use the last scintilla of independence of thought, which we have for long past been directing towards subjects and ideas useful to us, or for us. The system of bridling thought is already at work in the so-called system of teaching by object lessons, the purpose of which is to turn the goyim into unthinking, submissive brutes, waiting for things to be presented before their eyes in order to form an idea of them. End of quote. Let's face it. To date, they've done a better job in this war than we have. But if I can have anything to do with it, I intend to see that changed. And I hope that you will do everything in your power as well to do the same. One of the ways to do so is by exposing the tactics of the enemy. Expose what they're doing and how they're doing it. Just by reading from the protocols is one of the ways that it can be done. And it begins with their propaganda front. And thus, this series of messages, this will be part 3 of an expose of a media assault. On September 26, 1863, 2 days different from the previous date, on September 26, 1863, and do note the date, the year, it's important, Ferdinand LaSalle, in an address for which he was convicted of sedition and spent two terms in prison, declared this. He said, quote, our principal enemy, the principal enemy of any healthy development of the German spirit and the German people today is the press. The press, at the stage of evolution which it has now reached, is the true enemy of the people. An enemy all the more dangerous by reason of its many disguises. End of quote. I wonder what it is that he actually meant by that. Disguises are employed to cover up, to hide something or someone. Maybe LaSalle was referring to what the learned elders of Zion boasted of in 1897. Where they said, quote, one of the things that they said was, in the hands of the states of today, there is a great force that creates the movement and thought of the people, and that is the press. The part played by the press is to keep pointing out requirements supposed to be indispensable, to give voice to the complaints of the people, to express and create discontent. It is in the press that the triumph of freedom of speech finds its incarnation. Isn't that interesting? That the freedom of speech finds its incarnation. As I shared with you just a little bit ago, it was just 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, that I heard Paul Harvey say that it's time for the Supreme Court to start limiting our freedom of speech and our freedom of religion. Nearly quote for quote for what he said. Hard to believe he said it. And he wasn't quoting someone else. He was saying it for himself, what he himself believes. And yet, of course, it's fine to give the freedom of speech and religion, if you will, to the press. Let them have it. We'll continue back with this protocol. Through the press, listen to this last sentence. Through the press, we have gained the power to influence while remaining ourselves in the shade. Behind the scenes, that is. End of that quote. Protocol 2, Article 5, Sentences 1 through 5. Also, Protocol 3, Article 16, Sentence 1, it says, at the present day, we are, as an international force, invisible. End of that quote. With Protocol 4, Article 2, Sentences 1 through 2, and where it says, and who and what is in a position to overthrow an invisible force? And this is precisely what our force is. End of that quote. Well, that's one of the reasons why such messages need to be preached, where that invisible force becomes visible and is exposed, their tactics and all that they do. Also, Protocol 13, Article 6, Sentence 1, in which they boasted this, quote, who will ever suspect that all these peoples were staged, managed by us according to a political plan which no one has so much as guessed at in the course of many centuries. End of that quote. Disguises, cover-ups, behind-the-scenes control. I have to believe that's what Ferdinand LaSalle was speaking of. 2 days later, Mr. LaSalle also declared, if a man makes money by publishing a newspaper, by poisoning the wells by feeding the people a daily spiritual death, he is the greatest criminal that can be conceived. End of that quote. Now note how LaSalle described the media as being guilty of causing spiritual death. Now, most people wouldn't think. They wouldn't put the media in the spiritual realm, would they? But that's exactly where they're at. After all, it's a spiritual warfare that we're involved in, isn't it? A war, I guess I should say, that we're either engaged in or we're victims of. Mr. LaSalle also prognosticated. He said this, quote, with my soul full of sadness, I do not hesitate to say that unless a complete transformation of our press can be accomplished, if this newspaper pestilence shall continue 50 years more, the intelligence of our people will be destroyed. End of that quote. Well, he prognosticated, but it didn't take 50 years. 34 years later, the elders of Zion boasted, quote, the Goyim have lost the habit of thinking unless prompted by the suggestions of our specialists. End of that quote, Protocol 3, Article 10, Sentence 1. And for the most part, that's exactly where we still find ourselves today. But maybe, Lord willing, we can be a part of waking up some more of our people that they might begin thinking for themselves once again. In the previous two messages, I began tearing into the innuendos, the distortions, and the lies found in a St. Petersburg Times article concerning America's Promise Ministries' recent Florida conference. In that article, and this is where I left off in the last message, in that article it was stated that, quote, among those scheduled to speak, a tax-protesting minister from Missouri, a Holocaust revisionist from Idaho, and a Nebraska pastor, who I'm sure you don't know, and a Nebraska pastor whom one human rights activist described as, quote within a quote, a hardcore racist and anti-Semite, end of quote within a quote and end of quote. Well, in the last message, I began to share with you and to elaborate upon why I am considered, why I and others like myself are considered by a certain faction within our society as a, quote, hardcore racist and anti-Semite, end of quote. I came up with four reasons. First, because I teach today what is known as the Christian identity message. That is, rather than teaching that today's Jews are today's Israelites, I teach that the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, Celtic, and kindred peoples are the true descendants of the biblical Israelites. Second, because rather than teaching the equality of all races, I emphasize the diversity of all races. Third, because rather than teaching racial multiculturalism, I teach racial separatism. And fourth, because rather than promoting miscegenation or race mixing, I advocate racial purity. In the last message, I covered the first two of those admissions. So let's pick it up where we left off with the last two of those confessions. And actually, we'll blend them together because they really go hand in hand. Yes, it's true. I'm confessing. I do believe in racial separation and in racial purity rather than race mixing and multiculturalism. So now you've heard it from my own lips. But so what? Now it's time to start thinking again. The media and the government, just as the protocols said that they would, the media and the government have excited, using their terms, inflamed the non-thinking public to conjure up, and I use that word on purpose, to conjure up all kinds of horrible images when someone is identified, or better yet, when someone admits to being a racial separatist. Certainly, certainly not someone you want as your next-door neighbor. After all, such a person might go so far as to separate. Oh, how ghastly. Someone who wants to live a peaceable, secluded life with people of his own kind and beliefs. What vileness. And of course, I say that with tongue in cheek. You see, the general public, with colored, or maybe I should say colorblind spectacles astride their proboscises, never consider that that is all that separatism means. Someone who wants to be separate. That's not what they think, though, is it? Because the media, as the protocols talk about, with their colored glasses astride their noses, with the fact that the media has put these colored glasses astride their noses, they don't think that about separatism at all. They don't think about what the word means. They only think what they have been trained to think that that word is supposed to imply. Instead, separatism has somehow been equated in the minds of most Americans with radical, fertilized, bombing, hate-mongering racists. Isn't that the case? Well, hats off to the Antichrist. Our weapons, again, are weapons of truth. Theirs are weapons of deceit and lies and trickery, as their own Jewish Kabbalah states. And they have done a magnificent job in this war of thoughts and words and images. Much better than we have. And they deserve a tip of the hat. They've done their job well. Well, let's just ask the question, though. Really, what's so wrong with racial separatism? Well, let's first realize that the term separatism is only evil when it's white separatism. As a matter of fact, you never hear of red separatism. Anybody ever hear that term? And yet, there is red separatism. You never hear of yellow separatism. And yet there's plenty of yellow separatism in our world today. And you never hear of black separatism. And of course, if you ever did, or ever do, it certainly will not be given the evil connotation that white separatism has. Now, if in the previous two messages I have done my job, then you should now know to ask yourselves, why? If our people would only start asking that question, why? Why is that? Why is it evil and racism only when it's white separatism? Well, could it be? I only ask you to consider this. Could it be that it's simply been portrayed as that by the real racists, by people who hate the white race, specifically the Celto-Saxon man, my abbreviation of the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, Celtic, and kindred people, that it's actually been portrayed as such by Edomites, by those who God said would have everlasting enmity with the Israelites in Ezekiel 35. Let's turn to Ezekiel 35. Or before we go there, let's turn to Amos chapter 1. Amos chapter 1, we'll just be here just a second or two. Just verse 11, listen carefully to what it says. Amos 1 and verse 11, it says, "Thus saith Yahweh, for three transgressions of Edom." Now, who's Edom? For those who I hope this tape ministry gets to, they won't know, basically, for the most part, probably the majority of them will not know, even within the Christian world, will have no idea who Edom is because they don't read their Old Testament, they don't know the history of the Bible and what's led up to the New Testament era. So who is Edom? Well, Edom, or the Edomites, were the descendants of Esau, the twin brother of Jacob Israel. "Thus saith Yahweh," verse 11, "for three transgressions of Edom and for four I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because he did pursue his brother with the sword," Jacob Israel and his descendants, "and did cast off all pity, and his anger did tear," listen carefully, "and his anger did tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath," his hatred, "forever." Now turn to Ezekiel 35 in verses 1 through 5 for further verification of the same, second witness. Ezekiel 35, beginning with verse 1. It says, "Moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Mount Seir." Just another term for Edom. That was the abiding place, the geographical land area where Esau, Edom, initially resided. "Moreover," verse 1, "the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Mount Seir," against the Edomites, "and prophesy against it, and say unto it, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, O Mount Seir, I am against thee, and I will stretch out my hand against thee, and I will make thee most desolate. I will lay thy cities waste, and thou shalt be desolate, and thou shalt know that I am Yahweh." Verse 5, "Because thou hast had a perpetual hatred, and has shed the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword in the time of their calamity, in the time that their iniquity had an end." There was this perpetual hatred. Where did it begin? If you remember the story of when Rebekah conceived the twins, Esau and Jacob, that it began, that strife, the warfare began in her very womb. And as I pointed out in other messages, the scriptures tell us that Esau was born first, and thus had rightful claim as the firstborn to the blessings and the birthright. But it also says that Esau came out with Jacob holding on to his foot. You know, sometimes I think we just see this little baby hand holding on to the heel of the foot, you know. I think he had both hands clasped around the ankle of that right or left foot and holding on for dear life. And I think the strife that was going on in Rebekah's womb was warfare. In this particular case, they didn't have weapons of clubs or anything to beat with each other with, but what they were doing, obviously, were jockeying for position in the womb, trying to be the firstborn. And as things turned out, I think it was obvious that it was meant for Jacob, although he was secondborn. But if you remember, as the story progresses, as those two men grew older, the warfare that began in their womb continue through their lifetime, and obviously as we read these two passages, in the lifetime of their descendants, forever, perpetually, there was to be this. And it doesn't say that Jacob Israel would hate Esau Edom, but that Esau Edom would hate Jacob Israel. Why? Because Jacob Israel ended up with the birthright and blessings that God had obviously intended from them for them from the very beginning. God has told us that Esau Edom would have perpetual hatred for the Israelites. Now follow with me. In volume 6, page 378, under the heading Edom, the Encyclopedia Judaica declares, quote, "In the days of John Hyrcanus, end of the 2nd century BCE, and a little bit later, the Edomites became a section of the Jewish people," end of quote. And in volume 5, page 441, under the heading Edom Ejimia, the 1905 Jewish Encyclopedia states, quote, "They," speaking of the Edomites, "were then incorporated within the Jewish nation," end of that quote. And in the Antiquities of the Jews, book 13, chapter 9, verse 1, the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus declares that, quote, "They," again the Edomites, "they were hereafter no other than Jews," end of quote. So by these three Jewish authorities, actually four, because I didn't bother to quote the standard Jewish encyclopedia because it's so close, it basically says the same as the other ones. But by these three authorities and four, it's admitted that the Edomite nation was incorporated or swallowed up into and became a part of the Jewish nation, and they, the Edomites, became known as Jews. Now, following with me, according to Yahweh, as stated in Ezekiel and Amos, these Edomites, now known as Jews, were to have everlasting enmity with true Israel. Now listen to the following admissions from some modern Edomite Jews. First, again, from the Protocol. Last sentence of Article 3 of Protocol 9 reads, quote, and the weapons in our hands are limitless ambitions. Nobody would question that. Burning greediness. Not many would question that. And then it says, merciless vengeance. Hatreds and malice. End of quote. I didn't think to add this one in here. It would have been appropriate, but there's another place in the Protocols where it says they confessed, "We're the wolves," and the Goyim, specifically the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian kindred peoples, "are the sheep." And then it says, "And what do wolves do when they get in the sheep pen?" Wolves. That reminds me of Matthew chapter 7, I believe it is, where it says, "Beware of the wolves in sheep's clothing." And sheep were primarily, and it's talking about false prophets there, but maybe it could be applied as well. Weren't sheep the designation that God gave to his people? Beware of the wolves in sheep's clothing, or wolves who are proclaiming to be sheep, Israel. Seems to all fit together. Also consider what Elie Wiesel had to say in 1968 wrote in his book, Legends of Our Time. He said, "Every Jew somewhere in his being should set apart a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate, for what the German personifies and what persists in the German," end of quote. And it's interesting that he specifically centered on the Germans, because Jews, of course, in the minds of most people, are supposed to be at least Judah. And of course, they're not Judah at all. By their own testimony, by their own encyclopedias, by their own almanacs, and by their own famous and well-known anthropologists, they have nothing to do with being any kind of Israelite. But in the minds of most people, they're supposed to be Judah. That Judah, if you remember, was given the scepter, the ruling power within Israel. Excuse me. And now let me stop there and turn the tape. We'll come back to it. Judah in the scriptures was given the scepter, the ruling power, and of course that's primarily the part of Israel that Esau Edom would want to try to maintain, try to take control of, in order to get back the birthright and blessings lost to Jacob Israel. Now they may not even mentally know that's what's going on, but there's been this genetic imprinting that's happened. We found it in the book of Esther when Haman, who was a descendant, an Agagite, thus a descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites, who were of the firstborn line of Esau, fought against Esther and Mordecai, Esther being a, very likely, at least there certainly appears, being a direct descendant of King Saul, a Benjamite. Well, that just shows that the war has continued and continues today, this genetic imprinting. I don't think Haman knew why he was attacking, why he had this intense drive within him to wipe out and destroy the Israelites. It was a genetic imprint in his mind. I don't think he realized that it was him trying, as a people, trying to get back the birthright and blessings, but it would certainly appear that was the case. And thus this eternal enmity between these two people, or the one people upon the other. I forgot where I was going. Judah, speaking of the Germans here, why the Germans? Why center on them just the Germans when their hatred is for all Anglo-Saxons? Well, because evidence proves that it's primarily the Germans wherein you will find the Judah people. And thus this virile hate for the Germans. Likewise, in 1968, James Yaffe, in his book, The American Jews, on page 58, said this, quote, or wrote this, quote, it's almost as if some symbiotic relationship, he didn't know it, he'd probably been better off using embryotic relationship, the embryotic relationship of Esau, Edom, and Jacob, Israel. But he did put it this way, he said, it's almost as if some symbiotic relationship now exists between the Jews and the Germans. We can never break loose from them. We're doomed to go through the ages together, tied to them. And he could have left it there. Tied to them how or by what? Tied to them by our hatred. End of quote. Everlasting enmity of Esau, Edom for Jacob, Israel. Are you beginning to see the picture? Could this be the reason why the Edomite-controlled press identifies only white or Kelto-Saxon separatism as racism? Why it's only politically correct to attack the white man, excluding, of course, the Jewish man. That's the biggest taboo of all, is to attack the Jewish man. But that's why, could that be why it's politically correct to only attack the white man? Remember last year how General Mills was promoting a new and better Betty Crocker? Anybody remember that? I have a Casper Star Tribune AP News article entitled, Company Seeking New Politically Correct Betty Crocker. Now, what do you suppose they meant by a new and better politically correct Betty Crocker? Well, since Betty Crocker is not a living person and cannot espouse her beliefs, it has to be in how they represented her, how she was made to look. And just how is this, the new politically correct Betty Crocker portrayed? Well, here's what the article says. Quote, Golden Valley, Minnesota, AP. The new Betty Crocker will be a high-tech representation of America's melting pot. On the 75th anniversary of its Betty Crocker products, General Mills Incorporated announced Monday it is creating a new multi-ethnic image for the ultimate homemaker using a computer to blend the images of real women. For decades, and despite periodic updates, the fictional Betty Crocker, gracing boxes of cake mixes, remained a cheery, white-skinned, and blue-eyed Hausfrau. I think I'm pronouncing that correct. I take it's German, and it does mean housewife. With a sensible hairdo. Almost makes it sound bad, doesn't it? The plan calls for General Mills to select photos of 75 women out of a batch submitted by contestants across America and digitally meld them into the new Betty. And a little bit later it says, quote within a quote, we're hoping for ethnic diversity, which is what's happening with homemakers and society as a whole, end of quote. Never thought of this until just as I read it now. We're hoping for ethnic diversity. Now, how in the world can you get ethnic diversity if you meld them all into just one single person? That's not ethnic diversity. But again, they've been masters of the word game. Everybody thinks it's ethnic diversity, when in fact it's the destruction of diversity. Again, quote within a quote, we're hoping for ethnic diversity, which is what's happening with homemakers and society as a whole, end of quote. I beg your pardon, it is not. General Mills spokesman Craig Schoelstadt told the Wall Street Journal in Monday's edition. End of that quote from that article. Now, it's admitted that the Betty Crocker of old was a cheery, white-skinned, blue-eyed housewife. Now, let's first think, and then let's just be honest. If the Betty of the past had been depicted as a black Afro-American or an Hispanic woman, do you think General Mills would have given her this new facelift? Not likely. I have another newspaper article that's even more revealing. The May 28, 1994 Des Moines Register ran an article, believe it or not, entitled, quote, "Too Caucasian, Iowa's Image Too White, Says Grandy," end of quote. Written, by the way, by David Yepsen, Y-E-P-S-E-N, if that makes any difference. The article begins this way. It says, U.S. Representative Fred Grandy said Friday that the next governor should, quote within a quote, lead the charge, end of quote within a quote, to make Iowa a more diverse state and to help Iowans become more tolerant of non-white cultures. Grandy, who is challenging incumbent Terry Branstad for the Republican nomination for governor in the primary election June 7th, told a radio show Friday he wanted, quote within a quote, a new kind of image for Iowa, end of quote. Continuing, you can't allow people to get comfortable in their bigotry. You have to go at it full bore, he said. Well, I wonder how he describes his remarks. Again, but because it's in print and it's not explained to anyone today, to those who can no longer think except by the prompting of their specialist or the promptings of ours, everybody doesn't see that this guy is just as big a bigot or bigger than those he's trying to condemn. Going on, it says, Grandy said, quote within a quote, we have to acknowledge that we are, to some degree, a very kind of isolated and atypical state in this union because we are too predominantly Caucasian. For years and years, we have not really even confronted this issue. And then later, he said he would use, quote, the bully pulpit, end of quote, his quote, of the governorship to promote diversity and Iowa's multicultural heritage, end of quote. What a dichotomy of terms to begin with. First of all, he says it's too Caucasian, and then he says Iowa has a multicultural heritage. Time to think, people. Time to wake up. But they've gotten pretty bold, haven't they? Now, again, let's put on our thinking caps. Just how far do you think a politician running for a political office would get if he was to declare instead that California's image is becoming too Oriental, or Texas's image is too Hispanic, or Florida's image is becoming too Puerto Rican, or Mississippi's image is becoming too black, or New York's image is too Jewish? Just how far do you think he'd get? Well, I'll guarantee you this. He would get some press, but he wouldn't get the kind of press that Grandy got. I'll guarantee you that. Time to ask the question, why not? Why is that? Now, it needs to be pointed out as well that the Jewish people today are, that is, today's Edomites, as they should be correctly identified, are generally the most separatist people on the face of the earth. And yet, when have you ever heard the media say anything about Jewish separatism? Never. Anybody? Correct me if I'm wrong. Never, and you never will as long as the media is controlled and dominated by Edomite Jews. And now with your cognitive powers, hopefully, at work. It should also be pointed out that even though the Jews demand their separatism, it's the Jews who want the other races melded and mixed. I'm not sure quite how it plays in here, but I know it was one of the Jewish playwrights of years ago, and I I didn't think to even until now to put this in here, but he came up with a play that escalated him into popularity. It was called The Melting Pot. I think it's probably where the term originated with. Isn't that interesting? But the Jews who demand their separatism are the ones who want the other races mixed. Again, let's ask the question, why? Let's start it working. Let's try to get those juices a-flowing. And maybe we can come up with some answers. However, as made clear by the following quotations, race mixing is promoted by the Jews, but not participated in by the Jews, at least by those in good standing. From the mid-1800s to date, their agenda has remained the same, as these quotes verify. In 1844, Karl Marx, you say, well, it's Karl Marx. Well, you're going to see that Karl Marx was not the only one. It wasn't just a Karl Marx who promoted this. But in 1844, Karl Marx, and I'm sure that this agenda goes much further back than 1844 as well, but this is the furthest date back that I could come up with a quote. In 1844, Karl Marx wrote this. He said, quote, but the Jew likewise can only adopt a Jewish attitude, that is, that of a foreigner. And a little bit later he continued, he said, he considers it his right to separate himself from the rest of humanity. Now that's separatism, but it's never spoken of by the Jewish media. As a matter of principle, he takes no part in the historical movement and looks to a future which has nothing in common with the future of mankind as a whole. End of that quote. In the mid-1800s, in a letter to Karl Marx, Baruch Levi wrote this, quote, the Jewish people as a whole will be its own Messiah. It will attain world dominion by the dissolution of other races. End of quote. How? Well, by race mixing, if not by other more extreme measures. But race mixing will destroys the other races eventually. Continuing, he says, by the abolition of frontiers. How? Well, by multicultural, new age, one world order, global agenda, or whatever else term they come up that want to call that agenda as years go on. Continuing, he said, by the annihilation of monarchy and by the establishment of a world republic in which the Jews will everywhere exercise the privilege of citizenship. In this new world order, their term, the children of Israel, modern-day Jews misnamed, by the way, the children of Israel, the Jews, will furnish all the leaders without encountering opposition. Boy, I didn't even think about it. There are very few who are opposing what's happening in Clinton's administration. He's got more Jews in that administration than have ever been anybody's done anywhere close to that in the past, and nobody seems to care. The government, continuing, the governments of the different peoples forming the world republic will fall without difficulty into the hands of the Jews. It will then be possible for the Jewish rulers to abolish private property and everywhere to make use of the resources of the state. Thus will the promise of the Talmud be fulfilled, in which is said that when the Messianic time is come, the Jews will have the property of the whole world in their hands. End of that quote. Also, in 1869, in a funeral oration for Grand Rabbi Simeon ben Yehuda, Rabbi Reichhorn declared this, quote, the Jews will command the nations. They will summon peoples whom they do not even know, and people who do not know them will hasten to them. The riches of the sea and the wealth of the nations will come to the Jews of their own right. Any people or kingdom who will not serve Israel, the Jews misnamed, will be destroyed. End of quote. That's their idea of multiculturalism. Goldwin Smith, professor of modern history of Oxford in 1881, and I'm sharing with you more than one quote as we go through this, as time progresses here, to show you that the agendas remain the same, and it's not just Karl Marx who has that agenda. It is common with the Jewish people who are in the know and in control. Goldwin Smith, professor of modern history at Oxford in 1881, said, quote, we regard our race, as superior to humanity and look forward not to its ultimate union, multiculturalism, with other races, but its triumph over them. Especially pertinent, listen to Israel Cohen in 1912, and actually read into the congressional record I'm not sure at what date it was read into, but I do have that if you're interested in that date. From a racial program for the 20th century. Quote, we must realize that our party's most powerful weapon is racial tension. by propounding, wait a minute, I thought they wanted racial peace. Remember the disguises they wear that LaSalle back in the 1800s talked about? One of their disguises is that they portray themselves in a certain light that they're not at all. They portray themselves to the non-Jewish ears and eyes in one way, and then these kind of statements meant only for Jewish ears and eyes, it's something completely different. Again, from his book, A Racial Program for the 20th Century, quote, we must realize that our party's most powerful weapon is racial tension. By propounding in the consciousness of the dark races that for centuries they have been oppressed by the whites, we can mold them to the program of the Communist Party. In America, we will aim for subtle victory. While inflaming the Negro minority against the whites, we will endeavor to instill in the whites a guilt complex for their exploitation of the Negroes. We will aid the Negroes to rise in prominence in every walk of life, in the professions, and in the world of sports and the entertainment. With this prestige, the Negro will be able to intermarry with the whites and begin a process which will deliver America to our cause, end of quote. It's not only our people who need to wake up to what's being done to them, but the blacks need to be aware of it as well, that they're just pawns in the game that they are playing for the ultimate destruction of all other races. Also, in 1939, in a program for the Jews and an answer to all Semites, this will be the last quote, Harry Watton, W-A-T-O-N, wrote the following, quote, Judaism is the highest world philosophy which roots deep in the blood of the Jewish people. A world philosophy, just because it is a world philosophy, endeavors to become the only philosophy in the world and therefore cannot tolerate any other world philosophy. The Jews are always portrayed as this kind and gentle person who always have consideration for all others. Not hardly, just another disguise. He also wrote this, since the Jews are the highest and most cultured people on the earth, the Jews have a right to subordinate themselves and to themselves, the rest of mankind, and to be the masters over the whole earth. Now, indeed, this is a historic destiny of the Jews. End of that quote. And you say, anti-Semite, you sound like an anti-Semite. No! I'm just quoting to you what the Jews themselves have admitted. Now, how in the world can you identify that as anti-Semite? Unless you're brain dead and can't think, unless their specialists prompt you to do so in the fashion they want you to. Now, when was the last time that the general public was informed of that program, of the real agenda behind multiculturalism? I previously asked, what's wrong with racial separatism and maintaining racial purity? What's wrong with it? I mean, just think. I mean, we have this knee-jerk reaction that you bring up racial purity and all of a sudden, boy, who knows what you are in the minds of those people. Just think about it. What's wrong with it? And those are good questions to get people to think, but maybe I should ask it this way. What's right with them? Because not only is there nothing wrong with them, but there is also much that is very right about them. First, it's right, and this is good enough reason if there were no other reasons. First, it's right because Yahweh, our God, promotes them. That's right. God, the God of the Bible, promotes both racial separatism and racial purity. Racial separatism. Turn, and we're going to have to quickly. I'm talking too much in between my notes here, and we're going to run out of time if I'm not careful. Genesis chapter 11, verse 1. I'm going to read it as I get to it. Chapter 11, verse 1. And the whole earth was one language and one speech. Well, that sounds good in today's language. At least, certainly sounds politically correct. It certainly sounds a lot like what the one world multiculturalists have been promoting. You know, and everybody's been kind of swallowing that as something good. Even the churches today are promoting it as much as the secular world. Sounds good, but how did God look upon it? Verses 6 through 9. And Yahweh said, Behold, the people are one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So Yahweh scattered them, separated them, segregated them, if you will, abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because Yahweh did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did Yahweh scatter them, segregate them, separate them abroad upon the face of the earth. Interesting, as I read that too, I think of the term Babel. I think of what the multiculturalists have in mind and what their agenda is. And I think of who's behind it, the media and their controllers, and how what they have done with word power and their images that they build has been nothing but confusion. The people aren't confused in their mind until you say, wait a minute, why is this? Why is that? Have you thought about it this way? And all of a sudden they're thinking, man, yeah, this doesn't make sense. It's been nothing but confusion, but they've been entrapped and enslaved and shackled by this continuing confusion that came out of Babylon. Now, you know, when God joins something together, such as a man and a woman, he declares, what therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder or separate. So don't you think that just the opposite would be just as true? That is, that what God has separated, as in here in Genesis chapter 11, no, let no man join. Consider Deuteronomy 32:8. It says, quote, when the Most High divided, segregated to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. They were set, and he set boundaries where they were. Boundaries are where they're basically or generally meant to stay. Not that there can't be visitation, at least as long as each of those visiting submit to the laws of those who control that area. But there was boundaries set up. They were separated, segregated, and boundaries set up to keep them there. Now, you know as well as I do how the New Testament Judeo-Christian crowd is going to respond to all of that. Well, that was Old Testament policy. Well, let me demonstrate to you that our God's agenda hasn't changed. Turn quickly, if you will, to Acts chapter 17. And again, as I get there, I'll read it to you. Acts chapter 17, 26, and see if it sounds any different, what Paul is going to share with us here, than what we just read in Deuteronomy 32. Acts 17, especially if you read the whole verse. 17, and hath made of one blood. Let's start up a little bit further. God, verse 24, God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and has made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth. And that's where your multiculturalist and your integrationists, such as Billy Graham and others, always like to stop. They never want to read the rest of the verse. Yes, they were made to dwell on all the face of the earth. Mixed all together? No. And has determined the times before appointed and the bounds, or New American Standard, I think, says boundaries of their habitations. Yes, they were made to dwell upon all the earth. Where else would they be? In heaven? No. But separated, segregated. Both Old and New Testament alike, that has been God's agenda. Our God is a God of separatism, not one of a mixed multiculturalism. It may be their God, but it's not our God. What about racial purity? Well, didn't Yahweh, when creating his world order, declare his will to be kind after kind? And wasn't it? I mean, even to the point of that you're not to blend cotton and linen, that you're not to put an ox and a donkey in yoke together. Oh, I mean, down to that even point, don't you think it would apply to us as well? Especially since he separated us, there shouldn't be any mixing. And wasn't it Yahweh who inspired Moses to write Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 2 that, quote, a bastard or a mamzer or a mongrel shall not enter into the congregation of Yahweh, the geographical land area of Israel, even to the tenth generation, an idiom meaning forever, shall he not enter into the congregation of Yahweh? It's God. That's his will. That's his inspiration. Truly, our God is one that promotes both racial separatism and racial purity. Multiculturalism and miscegenation are sins against his intended order. And they are sins against society as a whole, and against, think about it, and against each race in particular. The Mediaites and their controllers have persuaded the general public that white separatists are out to destroy all the other races. Ding, ding, ding. Time to think again. How can anyone in their right mind believe such nonsense? Now, there are racists out there. You know, and there are those who hate the other races. I don't run across them. They aren't in the circles and I just came from a meeting of 500 plus of our people, and not once did I even come in across a hint of that. Of course, but there are exceptions out there in the Baptist Church, in the Catholic Church, in the Mormon Church, in Christian identity, and yet only Christian identity is attacked as being racist because there may be a few individuals who I've never run across who are true racist and who would like to see the other races destroyed. Why? Why is it just Christian identity? Is it because they have the answers to what's really going on the world front? This Esau-Edom, Jacob-Israel battle, the right identity of who's who? Time to think. How can anyone in their right mind think that? Separation is protection. Separatism is protection. It's multiculturalism that leads to destruction. Think about this. You can't be a white separatist without promoting a white separatist without also promoting separatism for all the races. Thus, white separatism promotes racial purity for all races and furthers their individual cultures. It's the multiculturalists who are bent on the destruction of racial diversity through their melting pot concept and through miscegenation. Multiculturalism eventually destroys race, heritage, culture, and customs, whereas separatism furthers all of that. As someone else once put it, interdependence cancels out independence and replaces it with dependence. At the hands of the media, the general public has just once again fallen prey, regrettably, to calling evil good and good evil. Why is it that I and others like me are labeled? Why is it as hardcore racist and anti-Semites? Well, I've made my confessions, my admissions in the last two messages, and now you should know. There's really only one reason why we're labeled as such. Because if enough people are ever awakened to what I have shared with you in this series of messages, it will absolutely destroy the Antichrist one-worlder's designs for a one-race theirs, global Tower of Babel world order. Hallelujah. And let it come quickly. I'd like us to take our Bibles this morning and turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. We'll be reading verses 3 through 5. In verse 3 it says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of the Christ." And I think it was in the last message that I pointed out that we don't really believe what those three verses say, because we'd be living a different life than we live. We'd be marching to a different tune, if you will, than we're currently doing. we would be doing what it does. We've been given the weapons that it talks about, that it speaks of. But the problem is, we may even believe in those weapons. But I don't think that we, as a whole, within Christendom today, have been using those weapons. Well, if nothing else, this passage of Scripture proves that we are at war. And that as Christians, we are to be engaged in that war. But regrettably, most modern Christians are passive and content to just fold their hands as if to be handcuffed and shackled while thinking to themselves they're godly and spiritual as they travel the road of non-resistance. Now, that may be the 20th century Judeo-Christian perspective, but it certainly was not the outlook of first century Christianity. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7, the Apostle Paul declared, "I have fought the good fight." And by the way, he wasn't confessing sin when he made that statement. Because in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 18, he also admonished Timothy to war a good warfare. And I don't care what the media thinks of the song we sing, "Onward, Christian Soldiers." The Apostle Paul clearly taught aggressive spiritual warfare, not passive non-resistance. Not that at times in history, in times in history the warfare has not escalated into a physical conflict, but as primarily described by the Apostle Paul, we are at least, or we should be, engaged in a war of words, wherewith we fight for the minds, hearts, and the souls of men. Essentially, a war of God's Word. That is, His worldview versus man's words and their worldview. That's where the bottom line of the war, where the war is fought. Again, there have been times in history, and there may be times in future history, where it escalates into a physical conflict, where the enemies, and it's usually the enemy who perpetuates it, matter of fact, it's always the enemy who perpetuates the physical conflict, but where they put themselves in a physical attack mode. But until then, it's primarily a war of words, where again, we fight for the hearts and souls and minds of men. And in this war, if our weapons of warfare are truth and honesty, then it's to be expected that our enemy's weapons of warfare are lies and distortion. That only makes sense that would be the case. On September 28, 1863, Ferdinand LaSalle declared this. He said, quote, "Daily news lies. Lies by means of pure fact alone. Lies by means of invented facts. Lies by means of facts distorted into their opposites. Such were the weapons with which we were fought." End of that quote. And remember, there's nothing new under the sun. What was true then is still basically true today. And let's face it, to date, our opponents, the Antichrist, have both understood and have fought this war much better than we have. Listen again to the protocols of the learned elders of Zion as an example. Protocol number 16, Article 1, Sentence 1, it says, quote, "In order to effect the destruction of all collective forces except ours, we, the elders of Zion and their lackeys, we shall emasculate the first stage of collectivism, the universities, by re-educating them." Words, thoughts, ideas. "By re-educating them in a new direction." End of quote. Originally, American universities were seminaries for the training of ministers. And look today what they have become. You telling me that's not fulfillment? I don't care who wrote them. The fact is, it has been and is being fulfilled. Same protocol, Article 4, Sentence 2. It says, "We shall erase from the memory of men all facts of previous centuries which are undesirable to us," end of quote. And look what they've done with our American Christian beginnings. They've taken it and removed it from the textbooks that our children used to be trained with. The only place you can find the true history of America's true Christian history anymore, is found in Christian bookstores. Books such as The Light and the Glory by Peter Marshall and David Manuel. Other than that, they've erased it. Thank God for such men. Same protocol, Article 8, Sentences 1 and 2. It says, "In a word, knowing by the experiences of many centuries that people live and are guided by ideas," thoughts, words, "and these ideas are imbibed by people only by the aid of education provided with equal success for all ages of growth, but of course by varying methods, we shall swallow up and confiscate to our own use the last scintilla of independence of thought, which we have for long past been directing towards subjects and ideas useful to us or for us. The system of bridling thought is already at work in the so-called system of teaching by object lessons, the purpose of which is to turn the goyim into unthinking, submissive brutes, waiting for things to be presented before their eyes in order to form an idea of them," end of quote. Let's face it. To date, they've done a better job in this war than we have. But if I can have anything to do with it, I intend to see that change. And I hope that you will do everything in your power as well to do the same. One of the ways to do so is by exposing the tactics of the enemy. Expose what they're doing and how they're doing it. Just by reading from the protocols is one of the ways that it can be done. And it begins with their propaganda front. And thus this series of messages, this will be part 3 of an expose of a media assault. On September 26, 1863, 2 days different from the previous date, on September 26, 1863, and do note the date, the year, it's important, Ferdinand LaSalle, in an address for which he was convicted of sedition and spent two terms for, declared this. He said, quote, "Our principal enemy, the principal enemy